Welcome to Art Watch, an enlightening foray into the lives of working artists. Come on in, step into our studio, and listen to something unique about the artistic development of some of our friends. I'm your host, Elisha. Our guest today comes from humble roots, a self-taught musician who built a reputation in the music industry through countless hours of work on a journey to become one of the best producers in the Midwest. I join him in his studio just off the Mississippi River, adorned floor to ceiling with thousands of books. Please welcome the man behind the library recording studio, Matt Patrick. Matt Patrick, thanks for joining us on Art Watch.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the room that we're in.
This is the library recording studio. I've been owner, operator, record producer of the library for 15 years. When I first found this space, it was just one big, huge, empty room. And so it had about a 5-second decay. It went when I clapped my hands. And I was like, okay, we're going to need to tame this room quite a bit. And so I had a library ladder at my previous recording studio, and I knew that I wanted to incorporate that into this room. And it was while I was installing the library ladder here that I thought, man, if there were books behind it, it would be such a cool look. And then I could call this place the library. And it was this instant thought, and just kind of fell in love with the idea, the notion of it. And within 2 weeks, I got my first score of, it was over 2,000 books, mostly hardcover, from a Catholic church school in South Minneapolis. And their only stipulation was you have to take all of them. And I'm like, oh, I'll take all of them. So
no problem.
Yep. No problem at all. And loaded up my van at the time and started, you know, building shelves. And it wasn't just the look, it was actually the sonic quality of having just, you know, a room filled with books. It acts as a diffuser. There's diffusion and reflection can be really bad in a recording studio, and diffusion is really good. You want the sound to just kind of like bounce around all over the place rather than back and forth between two solid surfaces. And so that's what the books did. And every time I put up a new wall of books, it was like, this room just sounds better and better and better. And so it became both form and function, and it was great. And what I love most about the library is that when people come in here, they say, you know, most studios feel really clinical, and this just feels warm and inviting and kind of an extension of my own home. And I tell people, don't ask to play any instruments. If you want to play an instrument, just pick it up and play it, you know, let inspiration strike, you know. And so I tell people, I'll get mad at you if you ask. So just start playing. You never know. You might grab some weird instrument you never played before and fall in love with the sound and decide to put it on your record, you know? So
you're a producer,
mm-hmm.
a musician, visual artist as well. Tell mm-hmm. us about all the work that you do.
Primarily, I see myself as a record producer first. That's what I love to do. I love to help people, and I love to encourage them and, you know, help turn them into something really special. And I also like being a behind the scenes guy. Like, I don't need to be on the cover of a record, you know, like just being inside the liner notes is enough for me. But I also like to have a really big impact. And so I may be on the liner notes, but there's a lot that you're hearing there that is because of, you know, the work that I've done in helping produce people. I'm also a musician. And so I've been playing music my entire life. I play lots of different instruments, mostly stringed instruments, guitar, bass, piano, mandolin, pedal and lap steel, dobro, but then also keyed instruments. So I can, because I can play piano, I can play accordion or organ or, you know, anything with keys on it too. And so there's very few instruments that I blow into because I get lightheaded and will potentially fall down on stage. So I try not to blow into instruments. and then I've been a songwriter. I've released 2 solo records, but not in a long time because I've been so busy working on other people's music. And then my entire family, they're all artists as well. So I grew up with illustrators and painters and photographers. And so I love photography as well. And so I do a bit of just iPhone photography. I see everything in little squares, you know, and post them on my own Instagram page. And it's all mostly just close-ups of just natural things that occur in the world that look like abstract art. And I really love that. Anytime that I can just be creative with my hands, with my mind, with my eyes, I like to do that. With my mouth. I love to cook as well, but it's not abstract.
Yeah, culinary arts as right, well. Exactly. Should have included that.
Right.
How'd you find your start in production work?
It wasn't because of a desire. It was because of a need. You know what I mean? Like I started playing piano when I was, whatever, 6 or 7 years old. My family inherited a piano. And I remember my mom sitting down and just like pulling out some sheet music and just playing Long, Long Ago and Far, Far Away. And just being like, wow, I'm 6 years old. My whole life, I've never seen you play an instrument before. It's mind blowing. And because you can do that, that means that I could do it too. And so she would leave and go upstairs and I would sit down and figure stuff out. And, you know, like, oh, these three notes are happy. But then you move the one middle note and it sounds sad, you know? And so those are major and minor. So I was kind of coming up with my own, you know, way of communicating with myself and with the instrument as to, you know, what these things are. And it was based on emotion. And so I've always played my instruments and written my songs based on emotion more than theory. But I'm almost 50. I've acquired quite a bit of theory knowledge in my time. But it's always been like, music has always been a direct link to my soul, you know? And so when I was growing up and I learned how to play piano, I needed to hear what was coming out, you know, aside from while I was playing it. And so I just grabbed a boombox and hit record and played on a cassette tape and then would rewind it and hit play and listen to myself. And then I would eventually like play a secondary piano part or sing a harmony to myself or both. I was like, man, if I could only record myself singing with myself, that could be really cool. Oh yeah, my sister's got a boombox, and so I went and grabbed hers. And so rewind the tape, hit play, hit record on my sister's boombox, and I'm playing a secondary part and singing a harmony to myself, not even realizing I'm actually multi-track recording as a six-year-old or whatever. You know, it was just like, no, this is I want to hear it, you know? And so it was just this thing I needed to do, it's this desire that I had. And so and then just, you know, over the course of years and getting a job and getting, you know, finances, you know, to be able to purchase equipment, then I got my first 4-track recorder and I got a guitar and started playing guitar and wanted to record that. And then I got a microphone and, you know, it just, you keep graduating into, you know, better ways of doing what you do, and getting better quality and getting better at the actual capturing of it. And so when I first did those early cassette recordings, boy, the tape degradation was just terrible when you go back and forth from cassette to cassette to cassette with just a built-in microphone on a boombox. It was just terrible. But then I got my first 4-track recorder and it was like, oh my God, this sounds really, really great. It didn't, but comparatively, yeah, it sounded amazing. And then I got my first digital recorder and then I got into Pro Tools and I'm amassing more and more studio gear and high quality studio microphones. And it got to a point where people were starting to take notice that even though it was a basement studio or a home studio, that it wasn't sounding like a basement studio. And I think it's just a direct relationship to when I first started. Like my path was set, you know, before I even knew what it was. And so I was just getting better and better at these things inherently without going to school or trying to, you know, pursue it really. I was just doing it because I wanted to do it. Took a liking to it and just had this innate ability with it, you know. And so once people started realizing like, oh, this sounds better than most basement studios, then they would come knocking on my door saying, hey, what you do sounds really good. Would you do that for me? I'll pay you money to do it. I'm like, sure. Make money to do this thing that is just this, you know, innate ability that I have, you know? Sure, of course. Let's do that. And then, you know, word gets out. You put your whole heart into work and more work comes back to you. And that's just the way that it works. And here we are, 5 studios later, three home studios, two professional studios, and more gear, more and more albums produced and recorded and played on, songs co-written, all that stuff. And here we are, 15 years into being the owner-operator of this place.
So totally self-taught as a musician and as a producer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't go to school. Matter of fact, I went to community college. And my first day of community college, I remember vividly, like it was yesterday, my theory instructor said, if you're here for a music education degree, I think you're going to really enjoy this class. If you're here for a music performance degree and you want to study classical music or opera, I think you're going to enjoy this class. But if you're here and you want to be a performer in popular music, there's the door and I suggest you use it. And I remember being just like, what? That's what I want to do. I want to be in bands and I want to write songs and I want to be on stage and I'm paying money to go to college and this guy's telling me to quit. So what he followed it up with was, you need to go out and play with and in front of as many people as possible. There's no piece of paper that you can get from any school that you can then take to First Avenue, for example, or Radio City Music Hall for another, and say, I got a diploma, give me a night. No, you need to prove yourself to the rest of the world and to the rest of the musician community out there that what you do is valuable and that people want to listen to it. You only do that by building a name for yourself. So that's exactly what I did. I quit college and I think I played in 8 bands that summer and then was still doing the recording stuff that I just did because I wanted to do it and loved to do it, you know.
Who were your first believers?
You know, it started with, you know, my mom saying, oh, wow, you're really good at this. We should get you a guitar. We should, you know, enroll you in piano lessons, which I hated because then I was being forced to do this thing that I just wanted to do, you know, on the side. And so forced practice was never really fun for me. I didn't want to practice. I just wanted to play, you know, and as I play, I would get better, not because I'm learning scales or modes or pieces, you know. And so, but she was definitely a big believer in me. My dad as well. He bought me my first electric guitar in 8th grade and for my birthday, and basically took me to a music store and said, which one do you want, you know? And but then, you know, the people who were listening to the stuff that I was working on and saying, you have something different and I want to be a part of it, you know. And then a dear friend named Bruce Belgard saw that in me and kind of took me alongside and said, hey, we should do some of this work together and make some music together. So we played in bands together. And there were times where he was the leader of the band and I was a side person. And there were times where I was the leader of the band and he was a side person. So we were really good at changing hats of who's, you know, who's in charge. And he was a mentor to me. There's a guy named Tom Herbers who had a recording studio called Third Ear and actually had on the opposite side of the control room, he had a wall full of books. And so I remember having the same conversation with him. Does that actually help the sound? And he's like, oh yeah. And he's the one who taught me about diffusion. Mm-hmm. Tom was the one who brought me to Guitar Center to buy my first actual Neve preamp and said, like, this is the one you want. Fork over the money, get this one. It's going to make your stuff sound great. All of my first recording I did was at Third Ear, and it was on 2-inch tape with a big, huge Neve mixing console and through all the best analog outboard gear. But yeah, that was a guy who believed in me then and still believes in me now, because he's been here to the studio and dropped off old files, you know, that we worked on together. And so, yeah. And then lastly, I would say my wife. When I first decided that maybe we should look into, you know, renting this facility and spending a bunch of money on the build out of it, I immediately just felt like, oh no, this is too big. I'm biting off too big of a chunk. I won't be able to swallow it. And she's like, no. You have return clients. People love working with you. You care about what you do. I believe in you if you don't believe in yourself. So I will take on this amount of money with you and we'll take out a big loan and we'll pay it off in 3 years. And trust me, this is what you're supposed to do. So I've had really good success stories with people who believed in me.
The aspiring producer watching this, mm-hmm. What advice do you have for them?
there's a couple different ways to go about it. There's the, I'm just going to go to school and learn as much as I can and then come out of school and hopefully get a job at a recording studio. And then there's the, I'm just going to start buying small amounts of equipment and then sell that equipment and get bigger equipment and get better at it. And then ask my friends just to come over and I'm just going to record you for free. And then that's my schooling. And so the road that I took was the latter. You know, I'm just going to buy what I need to make what I need. And I'm going to record people for very little or no money, or, you know, like start raising my rates as the interest grows, and just kind of doing it more naturally and more organically. And I've found that the success stories come from that approach as well. There, at one time, just a handful of years ago, there, I think there were 6 or 7 schools in the Twin Cities that had recording programs where you could actually get a diploma or get a certificate that says that you have graduated from the, you know, arts recording music program at their school. And I was inundated with emails from people saying like, can I come work for you? And the reality is I only have one workstation, you know? If you work in a cubicle at an office space and somebody says, can I come and work alongside you? You go, no, there's no room and there's one computer. So no, it doesn't make any sense. It's not going to help me out by having you take up my space, you know? And I love my job. And so I don't want to farm off my work to somebody else. Like that's my work. That's what I want to do, you know? And so I think maybe someday I could see, you know, retirement age comes and I find some young producer who's doing what I did when I was in my mid-20s and, you know, handing it off to them and saying like, you can come and just work in this facility and I'll pay you to work here. But then a portion of it goes to me because I'm the owner and I'm the one who have accumulated all of this gear over the years. And so other than that, I just don't see it making any sense to bring anybody else on as an employee. And so therefore I think it proves my point that if you just start small and school of hard knocks, just like learn as you go, and then you're, you know, rather than spending $50,000 per year, you're saving that money and able to invest that money into your equipment and the time into your skill, you know. And so That would be my advice. Just start small, start amassing your gear and your knowledge, and you get to a point where you're someday sitting in a recording studio, if that's what your life is meant to do.
You bring up an interesting point, which is the life cycle of studios in this industry.
Mm-hmm.
The last century has seen the creation of the recording industry, massive changes in multi-track recording, like you mentioned, the digital age now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the next 5 or 10 years or 20 years look like for this industry?
Yeah, it's interesting. Technology has really changed everything. I mean, there was a time where you absolutely had to go to a recording studio if you wanted to record anything, whether it was a voiceover or music or whatever. My grandma even was a poet, and she went into a recording studio to record her poems, and they hired somebody to play harp behind her while she read her poems. It's really sweet. I still have the cassette tape at home, you know? But nowadays, all you have to do is buy a laptop. And whether you're interested in music or not, if you buy a Mac laptop, it comes with GarageBand. So you have a fully functioning recording studio at your fingertips. And it's not unlike the iPhone. I mean, whether or not you're a photographer, there's a camera on your phone. And the ability with this camera is pretty mind-blowing. I remember buying a DSLR camera, you know, back in the mid-2000s and thinking like, wow, this is just such a amazing, you know, this looks so professional. And I take video or photos with my camera now and I compare it to my old DSLR and oh my gosh, my iPhone camera looks better than that DSLR that had this beautiful lens and all this glass behind it. And I mean, what does that say for our future, you know? And now we have, you know, AI, which people are saying that AI is just going to start writing songs for you, you know, and you can take, you know, somebody who's passed on, Freddie Mercury's voice, and have him sing a duet with you. Like, that's crazy. But I think used in the right context, it can prove to be a really valuable tool. You know, I heard that Paul McCartney is going to do a Beatles track with John Lennon singing a new Beatles song that he's writing. Some people are against it. I think it's a way of using technology to your advantage. Like, he's going to be the first to do that, you know? The first time that somebody, you know, had Tupac Shakur show up on stage and it looked like him, was pretty mind-blowing. The first time Cher did the crazy auto-tune vocoder thing, everybody was like, what even is that? And now it's become a mainstay. And so, so it's always impressive to be the first person to do that new thing, you know? So I don't know where it's going. I think technology is going to just make it easier and easier and easier. And the science behind all of these things, you don't have to know. I am a photographer, but I don't understand f-stop at all. I don't get it. But I don't have to. What I have to have is a good eye, and I do have that. And I have to have just good basic intuition and abilities. And the science stuff will just take care of itself because it's all zeros and ones, you know? And I think that that's kind of a cool thing, because then the really talented people are the ones who are going to float to the top. And the ones who aren't so talented, they'll keep working at Starbucks.
Yeah, until the AI espresso machines replace them.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And man, Matt, I can't wait. 100 years from now, digital hologram Matt Patrick,
right,
sitting behind that desk over there.
Right.
What's your favorite project you've worked on?
Boy, you know, it sounds trite because everybody says the same thing. They're like your kids. How can you pick a favorite child, you know? So I don't know that I have a favorite. And they've all been so different. At this point, I've worked on so many different styles of music. Yeah, and some people have really like opened my mind about styles. I never thought that I would care about this style before, but they come in and they have their own way of doing it. And then I have a new appreciation for it. And I love that. Yeah, there are, you know, bands like my own band, which is Grey Coats, which is very much like a art rock band. And anytime we do like an album release, we do some big event, you know. Our last one was like a multimedia presentation. We had an album that was basically like a rock opera that was based on the life of like a mashup of Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker and their lives, and just kind of took their stories, combined them into one, embellished it a little bit.
Charisma, and, by the way, is phenomenal. Charisma, check it out online.
Yeah. And then we had an acting component, and we had a film component, and we had a live band component in our performance. We did three nights that were basically all sold out at a theater here in Minneapolis. And it was a pretty incredible thing to be a part of. It was quite an undertaking, but I'm super proud of that for sure. And so that's been a really fun project, you know. And then there are others that have been like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was there to witness what happened. Like Corey Wong has now, you know, become a bit of a household name, especially in the world of guitar virtuosos. But yeah, he's been here, recorded several tracks here for a couple of releases of his, and seeing Sonny T, who played with Prince, and you know, just people in this studio who are just at the top of their game, and in just a matter of two or three takes, just playing the most mind-blowing stuff, and I'm capturing it and trying to get it to sound as good as possible. And like, did that just happen? Did I just witness that happen? And so yeah, it's a pinch yourself moment. Like, I can't believe that this was the facility to do it in, that this was the vehicle to drive them there, you know? So I'm super honored by that. And so every single album that I produce, I put my whole heart into. And so every single album that I work on, there are moments of, wow, I can't believe I just saw that happen or was a part of that happening.
It's one of my personal favorite experiences when you're listening to a live session happen and you get chills, mm-hmm, knowing that the take that you just heard is the take that's going to be printed.
Yeah. And oftentimes you can tell in the middle of it, you know, like, you know, in Pro Tools, I'm, you know, seeing everything in red and like, it's all red, meaning we're recording and we've done this like three times in a row and now it's the fourth take and everybody's just firing on all cylinders. And I have this moment every time of just like, this is the one. I'm the only one in the world who's listening to these people do it live right now. And everybody else is going to listen to the version of what I'm hearing right now, but I'm the one who gets to hear it as it's happening. Mm-hmm. So I'll look out the studio window and just like, look at these musicians and just, awe, you know, I can't believe that I'm watching this final take happening right now. You know, it's incredible.
Where do you hope to go in the future?
I've always been like, head down, keep working, make whatever project I'm working on the most important project that I have, you know. And I'm really in the service industry because when, you know, a singer-songwriter comes to me with this money that they've saved up, or they've asked people to donate towards it, or to buy advanced copies of their record or whatever, it's such a special thing. I'm entrusting you with all of this money to make my dreams come true. Will you please make my dreams come true? And that's like, that's heavy, you know? And so I take on that responsibility, that, you know, that mantle of leadership is handed to me. And I just go, yes, I will do my very best to make you something that you're really, really proud of, regardless of the style, regardless of who it is. And so I've always been just like, head down, keep working. You know, I've toyed with the idea or the notion of having my own building, but I've really got it good here, and I have friends who've purchased their own buildings and all of the headaches that come with it, like having to replace a furnace or having to re-roof or whatever. And it's like, yeah, well, there was $17,000 that just blew away in the wind that I was hoping to spend on other things, like my mortgage or my, you know, or my food for my family, you know? And so, 15 years I've been here, and it's pretty great. So my hope for the future is that I can just keep working on great music and help folks make their dreams come true.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening to Art Watch. If you enjoyed the show, please write a review, leave a tip at leaveatip.org, or if you can, support the production with a monthly donation. Information on this, links to Matt Patrick's work, future episodes of this show, as well as the video version of the podcast, can be found at artwatch.us. Art Watch is made in partnership with the Fribourne County Arts Initiative. Located in the heart of Albert Lea, Minnesota's historic district, the FCAI is the go-to nonprofit for pioneering new shows and artistic concepts. This program was also made possible with generous support from the Minnesota State Arts Board, the Southeastern Minnesota Arts Council, and Fribourne Maurer Cooperative Services. Art Watch is a production of Inkfish Design Studio. Executive producer, Elisha Marin. Thanks for joining us on this one. We look forward to seeing you next time. Till then, take care.